At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey there. This is relationship coach Roy Biancolana, a recent guest on the very podcast that you are about to listen to. Well, get ready and buckle your seats because Aubrey is about to take you on the road to rediscovery with another great episode. Sit back and enjoy.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on The Road to Rediscovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, take it to the next level and uplift others who are struggling through dark times. Now, a quick reminder that you can hear the Road to Rediscovery anywhere you get your podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, we invite you to leave a rate and review. Otherwise, please shoot us an email at roadtorediscoverypodcast@gmail.com. That's roadtorediscoverypodcast@gmail.com. And we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. We really, really appreciate your support and feedback. Now, as you know, this show thrives on featuring amazing guests who have overcome tremendous struggles and challenges for your benefit, right? But not for your benefit and not just knowing that you're not alone in your pain, but also for learning tools and techniques, right, to overcome your adversity. The storms of adversity always seem to hit us when we're in a seemingly less than ideal state, doesn't it? In my opinion, by definition, that's why they're called struggles, right? I don't think these would be such a struggle if we were in an ideal or optimal condition. That's just my humble opinion. Having endured an abusive childhood, post-traumatic stress, mental health challenges, and a lot more, my special guest has not only overcome, he's thrived and continues to thrive. Having finished an Ironman, ran the Boston Marathon 5 times, including once on crutches. Oh my goodness. And has earned a black belt. Also thriving in his career as a top mortgage originator, he's also raised over $500,000 for the Make-A-Wish Foundation and is the founder of the Thrive Foundation, a nonprofit foundation. We're going to talk about it all, ladies and gentlemen, the highs, the lows, as well as his new book, Thriving in the Storm, 9 principles to help you overcome any anxiety. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Mr. Bill Murphy. Bill, it's so great to have you on the show, sir. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Aubrey. I'm excited to be on here with you.
Oh, thank you, sir. We appreciate your time and coming on the show for sure. Now, Bill, I understand that you were consistently consumed with fear and doubt early in life. Can you start by giving the listeners a glimpse into what was life like for Bill Murphy growing up?
Yeah, so it's a pretty rough childhood. You know, I grew up in a pretty toxic environment, and it was a lot of shaming, a lot of physical and verbal abuse. You know, never could rise up enough to please, you know, my dad in this case, you know, to make sure that, you know, he was satisfied or happy. And it was always, I was never good enough. So there's the unworthiness, and you know, and it was never, nothing I did was ever good enough. So then I learned to get out of the way, because there was always usually consequences for me not being good enough, usually in the form of chores. And it was something that, you know, if he was going to treat me to a fishing trip or a hunting trip that I didn't want to go on, then I would pay the price. It would be, you know, it was just, I just learned to get out of that. So that was the unworthiness, the doubt, mm-hmm. never good mm-hmm. enough. I would just, mm-hmm. it was not a clean act to persevere and develop mm-hmm. Those, it was survival back then, survival mm-hmm. strategies to make it. And then it was part of, you know, spite. I'll show you that I'm worthy. Mm-hmm. I'll show you that I can make it. I'll show you that I'm good enough. And so mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. That was kind of the mindset there.
So it sounds like there was a sense of resilience in the I'll show you phase. But one thing I've seen, I guess, in the formative years, right? Children can be quite impressionable. And the it's not good enough. Did any a part of that in your early childhood years, I guess anywhere between 5 and 10, give you any sense of, I don't know, self-doubt, inadequacy, maybe attack your self-esteem or impact your self-esteem in a negative way?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I loved to lose myself in sports. And I was a decent athlete, but I always had to work hard. You know, I had to work hard as everybody else. But I would lose myself in sports. But I think all that doubt that was on my shoulders from the home life carried on the field. So, I mean, to this day, I look around and I'll be, you know, lining up in a marathon or, and it's my 7th or 8th one, or I'll be doing an Ironman and it's mm-hmm. been multiple. And I look around, I'll be like, look at these athletes and look at these, you know, these human freaks of nature and all this other stuff. Like, do I belong here? And then I have to talk myself into, yes, I'll show them that I belong here, that kind of thing. So as you asked that question, you brought me back to the same, it was the same way to persevere back then as mm-hmm. a kid to mm-hmm. the adult life. I mean, we're unpacking that, but, you know, and I've worked through it, but that's, you know, even my martial arts, you know, I work hard, I work hard, and, you know, when I'm on the mats or on the floor, it's, you know, I know I have the physical ability to hang, and yet the doubt creeps in. So yeah, sure.
Yeah, no, I understand. And thank you for clarifying that, Bill, because that's one thing I like for us to unpack for the listeners. And you clearly did that in the source of that resilience, right? Because at age 5 or 6, we're still trying to feel our way through, right? And the feedback and things that we're getting from our parents, older siblings and things like that, you know, I mean, these are people we count on. These are people we look up to. And when there's disappointment, you know, whether it's our fault or not, I mean, you know, we don't want to disappoint, you know? And so we feel it's easy to feel, you know, like having a sense of low self-esteem, self-doubt, adequacy, inadequacy, and that sort of thing. So it seems like your source of resilience came from feeling like you had to prove yourself that you were worthy of being amongst the other athletes, like in school sports and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it also translated into workaholism. Workaholic. Now, so extreme sports and workaholism is the path that I went down with my upbringing. Now there's this test. There's this test. It's called an ACE test, adverse mm-hmm. childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. And I actually went through some treatment and I took that test not too long ago on my road to rediscovery, in my late 40s. And that test revealed a very high number. And when I sat down with the doctor, that the psychiatrist that went over with me, he said, statistically, you should be dead or in jail based on your scores on this ACE test. He said most people turn to drugs, alcohol, violence, gang activity, pornography, obsessive compulsive eating and gambling, or a combination of all of them. And you turn to workaholism and extreme sports. And yes, that was socially acceptable, but man, it was still dangerous. And it was dangerous in the form of my angst, my anger, my tension would be, I would take the office home with me. I would take a bad day home with me. And I would yell at the kids for having the TV on too loud. And I was that was how I acted out with the childhood adverse experiences in my later years. It took a lot of, we talk about unpacking, it took a lot of uncovering and peeling back to figure all of that out, because I grew up saying my childhood was normal. Like I would tell stories matter-of-factly as if like, you know, it was a conversation at the dinner table when I got put through the wall, knocked unconscious, and had to patch it up the next day. What'd you have for dinner? We had steak and potatoes, you know, like, so it was just kind of, it was that kind of feeling up until recently. And that adverse test, the childhood, the ACE test certainly shed some light on that. And then the question that follows that is, you know, with your workaholism and your extreme sports, what are you running to or from? And that was a question that was asked of me. And man, I was running from my dad to show, we talked about this earlier, to show him that I'm capable, to show him that I'm not who he is or who he thinks I am. And so that carried on into the adult years too. But again, we certainly had our consequences with that. Again, I didn't go down to the violence and some of the other stuff that could have been a rough road.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And you know, I was wondering, you know, what caused you to take the path of workaholicism and physical activities, you know, working out, you know, versus it's a natural default, I think, for people to revert to relapses, self-medicating, you know, violence, that sort of thing. But you went this direction, and it seems like that ACE test may have given you some revelations as to why you went that direction versus everyone else.
Yeah, it helped me understand. It helped me understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was
fantastic.
Yeah.
You had another point you wanted to mention?
No, it was, I probably would rather be on the field than smoking dope behind the school in the schoolyard, you know? So maybe that's why I went on the wrong path. Or I'd rather be making money and working than, you know, going down the wrong road here. And maybe with it. I enjoyed those paths more than the alternative.
Understood. And so, you know, as you were saying, you brought up a very good point of in reflection, right? There's a question we must ask ourselves, and it sounds like it was presented to you. Am I running towards something or running from something, right? One other question I think that may come to the table, I'm not sure if it has in your journey, but if you could share, if possible, when you do these things, you know, I'll show him, when you're showing him, quote unquote, you know, are you doing it? Are you doing it for him or are you doing it for yourself? You know, performing great in sports, you know, who are you doing it for? Were you ever faced with that question at any part of this journey?
It's a very profound, deep question, and it's a great question. So I do know, and it was a lot of reflection on why I you know, who I was doing it for.
Yeah.
I want to bring this full circle. I was doing it for spite. Initially.
Yeah.
I was motivated to, it was my way of revenge. I will show you, I will earn this. I will make that. I will become this person to show you. It was a form of revenge. But here's the thing. A lot of people turn to, I'll show you revenge to carry them through life. Man, does that get exhausting. That will suit you if you don't figure out to run to the reward once in a while.
Right.
It's like this kind of lays out perfectly. When I would train for an Ironman or a marathon, or I would work towards a goal, a work goal, or some type of accomplishment or achievement, I had blinders on and I was just steamrolling and just knocking everything out of its path, not seeing anything, not taking anything in. And the problem with that is I hit the goal and it was on to the next thing. And who did I hurt along the way? Who did I miss along the way? What birthday did I miss? Did I not go to my kid's recital? What did I not do? What did I miss? So this is where now I run for the reward. I do the reward. And that is to stop on the journey and look around and take that breath in and high five the people that are supporting you and hug the people that care about you. And thank everybody that lifted you up and not steamroll and have motivation, a screw you attitude, because that will rip you apart. It can take you so far, and you can use it once in a while. You hear that term bulletin board material, but bulletin board material on that bulletin board every single day just gets old. You can use it once in a while, motivation, but then you have to compartmentalize it and then enjoy some of these things that you're going towards.
Yeah, that's true, right? Stop and smell the roses, for a little while, and be more thoughtful and strategic in your growth and the things you achieve and succeed in, just as you have, Bill, and celebrate those wins, celebrate the time with your family, celebrate those birthdays, celebrate, your son winning his first knot hole baseball game, and those are very, very important things. And at what point in your adulthood did you discover this?
Well, I've discovered it all along the way, because the motivation was I will not be him. Right.
Right. Right.
That was it. But I was still him in other ways. So like one of the things I did was I coached my kids and I had a job in sales that I could take off and be flexible. So I could go to my daughter's dance recitals and cheerleading competitions. Mm-hmm. And I could coach my son in football and baseball and hockey and lacrosse and all these things. I coached him since he was five years old all the way through high school. And so like I did those things because that wasn't done for me. You know, I made sure I showed up there. But what I didn't do that I realized later is I did bring the tension into the house. I did bring my anger into the house. I did bring my bad days afterwards when I didn't see my kids all day. And instead of hugging them, I was saying, shut that TV down or whatever. And that was him. So it's a process, right? And that's part of the journey. Yeah. It's like, let's figure this out and just try to get better and grow every single day to understand that you're still gonna learn, and we're still gonna get better as we go through this.
Oh, totally, totally. Bill, you have a tremendous sense of self-awareness, and I can tell in you saying, you realize that shades of your father were coming through in things that you would say or snap at your children for having the TV on or something. But you had the self-awareness and the wherewithal to recognize that and to also understand that it's part of the journey and that, you know, this is something that you are processing through. And I think I've always said on this show, self-awareness is the foundational cornerstone of four cornerstones to personal growth, right? Self-awareness, gratitude, humility, and service to others. Self-awareness has to happen first for any of those to happen. And you have a tremendous amount of a tremendous sense of self-awareness, which to me is that just speaks volumes to where you are today.
Today, but self-awareness also begins with self-love, and I never had that.
Right. And
so, and you're absolutely right. I am self-aware now, but like I was self-aware about most of myself, except me, my younger child, that I told you that the matter-of-fact stories of, you know, the ridicule, shaming, and beatdowns.
Yeah.
But Aubrey, if you told me, you know, your son went through this or your daughter or your neighbor's kid or your niece or nephew went through some of the things, I would be here and I would well up and I would get teary eyed. But when I told those stories a couple of years ago, I was like, yeah, no big deal. That was life. That's how it rolled. But when you start to get that self-love and start to getting touch and love your younger self, man, that changes everything. So then you can start to heal, right?
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. So yes, I'm saying I did everything to spite my dad and everything. Now, could you imagine we're on this show, Road to Rediscovery, and I'm talking about how painful my childhood was, and I have ill will towards my father. I don't, and I never really had. Is there forgiveness? I don't even really go to the forgiveness card because I didn't really hold it against him. I just wanted him to change who he was, but I have no ill will. So, but if you do, if you've been wronged, it is so important, first of all, to forgive yourself. Don't blame yourself. Forgive yourself if you've been wronged or you feel like you've been wronged. But here's where the magic happens is if you felt wronged and you're able to forgive and love yourself, try practicing forgiving that other person where you feel ill will or you feel wrong. And if you can do that, wow, do the floodgates open. And let's take it a step further. Not only forgive, but send blessings. If you can send blessings out and say, you know what, we're done, or, you know, I forgive you, or, you know, we're on another chapter in our lives, either together or not together or whatever it is, but I wish you the best. And I wish this for you, because if you root for karma, you're asking the universe to proverbially strike you down with lightning. You know, you can't do that. Yeah. You can't root for that. And that's why I say that revenge as motivation. Yes, you can use that to fuel you, but you don't want to use that to wish ill will on others. I swear that comes back to you like a boomerang.
Oh, tenfold, exponential. And as you were saying this, Bill, it reminded me of just the brilliantly titled chapter one of your book, Make Peace with Your Past. And, you know, I'd love for you to share a little more insight on what that means. Beyond the obvious, right? So making peace with your past, making peace with someone who has directly wronged you. But then there are some people that may have played parts that may have been a part of the experience from an indirect perspective, okay? And if you don't mind me asking or saying this, an example, for instance, like your mother was very emotional about, you know, just wishing that she could have done more and so forth. So I would imagine there's some peace in that regard. I'm not saying forgiveness, but some peace in that regard of your past that needs to be addressed as well.
Yeah. So I actually went through an intensive, right? So we had to unpack it was called our trauma egg. And this is when I learned a lot of this stuff. And I told you about the ACE test. And one of the things they want us to do is remember what happened to us before we were five. Do you know I couldn't remember a damn thing? And
Really?
so I called my mother and my sister, and I called my mother and I said, "Ma, what happened?" She's like, "I don't remember anything." And you know what's happened is, like, during the beatdowns, the ridicule and the shaming and all this other stuff, I don't ever remember seeing her in the room as a kid. And she may have disappeared subconsciously. She may have removed herself. Like, I think she just didn't want it, and she didn't remember. We hung up the phone, and this is when I was in that intensive a few years ago. She called me back less than 5 minutes later, hysterically crying. And she was telling me story after story after story, and all stuff just flooded out. And she's like, she just told me the other day, she listens to these podcasts. Ma, I love you if you're listening. And she said, "I was a bad mother. I was such a bad mother. Will you forgive me? Will you forgive me?" I was like, "Ma, you did the best you could. You know, we grew up in an Irish Catholic, lower middle class neighborhood in the 70s, and like the wife, the mom, couldn't quote unquote leave. What am I gonna do? I'm not working. I'm a stay-at-home mother. There's only one car. There's only so it's like that's they felt barricaded in. So she starts telling me all these stories about being harnessed to cribs and being put underwater to stop crying and all this stuff, like waterboarding, right? And I said, "My, don't beat yourself up. There's nothing you did wrong. You weren't physically present, and you didn't think you were capable of doing enough to prevent whatever you did see." And so I can't say it enough that she's a great mom, and that if she does want me to tell her I forgive her, I forgive her. But I never held anything against her. Know what I'm saying? And
Yeah, I do.
so when you say indirect, I think I knew where you're going with that, and that's how that's played out over the years. And with my father, he's still around, and it's awkward, but I would love to see him turn his life around and leave a legacy somehow, and give back and be a community person, and be a good grandfather if he chooses to. But I used to kind of push that out there to him, and it's up to him to make that decision. I can't make anybody's legacy for them. They can only make their own legacy.
So true. In fact, as you were mentioning that, I had a question for you regarding your father, and I think it's moot at this point, right? I mean, there's nothing we can't go into the heads of other people and figure out what makes them tick or why they treat us the way they do. But if I can ask you, Bill, have you ever thought of why he treats me like this? Is he threatened by you? Is he threatened by the pressures of being a provider and the patriarch for the family? I mean, those are just things we may speculate, but there really is no answer. We won't know the answer. But has it ever, it sounds like it hasn't crossed your mind as much because you have such a kind, thoughtful heart. Not to even hold it against them for doing those things, therefore there's no reason to forgive. Can you share with us some insight on that?
I always wanted him to see that he was a jerk, like, understand you're a jerk. So let's, and I was too, right? So when we talk about bringing that tension home and taking it out on the family, that's being a jerk. All right, he's being a jerk. But he lived being a jerk, and he never saw that. And I wish he did. So then it's time, when you get older and you retire and everything, to start to figure out, what? I got to figure out a way to make this place a better place today, that I'm while I'm still here. and that should happen. And I used to try to push that, and I can't make that happen. And so I don't know if that will ever happen, but I can't root for it. All I can hope is hope that it does.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I answered the question.
No, you did. And I appreciate it. And it's a reflection, like I said, of your thoughtfulness and your kindheartedness. And like I thought, you know, it is moot. I mean, it doesn't make any difference what we think is going in their heads as far as why. And you were clear in saying that, you know, you just wanted him to realize that he was a jerk, you know, and so, yeah, you clearly answered the question for sure, Bill. Now, I wanted to ask maybe one more question on from a childhood to adulthood reflective perspective. Okay. And then I want to talk about just some of the great learnings that you've had and some of the great teachings that, you know, your book, that readers can expect to get from your book, right? The value. So, Bill, one thing I read that you shared, okay, is talking about the relentless abuse from your father, right? Even as a baby, you talked about, you know, the waterboarding, holding you under a faucet in the kitchen to get you to stop crying, and the physical and the emotional abuse from grades, the chores, right? Pulling up the poison ivy and so forth. And then just out of the blue, while you're sleeping, coming into your bedroom and ripping you from the bed, right? I mean, I can't begin to imagine, you know, how frightening that would be, surprising and frightening, and laying down at night wondering, okay, is this going to be the night that he yanks me from it? You know, and how do you even expect it? You're sleeping, you know? So, you mentioned, and I quote in your book, I tried to forget those nights, but I clearly didn't, because as an adult, I would always sleep close to the door. I didn't realize it at first, but that's what I did. Can you explain how you connected the dots to come to that realization that brought you back to the nights that you were ripped out of your bed? Because there's some reflection that was going on there that to make you come to that realization.
Yeah. So when I was younger, I had a bunk bed. And so if I did something wrong and I knew I was going to pay the price when he got home, I barricaded. So I would like take stuffed animals and I would either put it on the top bunk or the bottom bunk so I could prepare and wake up in time for what was coming. You know, sometimes it was, booby trap him on the top bunk so I could be on the bottom bunk when I get yanked out. When I hit the floor, it wasn't as hard because it wasn't as far of a landing. But in all seriousness, I did do that. But what I realized is in relationships, whether I was in high school, college, up through here I am in my 50s, you know, if I'm in a hotel room, if I'm with my significant other or whatever, I need to be to the side of the door. I wasn't a good sleeper until probably the last couple of years. I would sleep basically with one eye open, and I never really understood that, but I would always be next to the door on that side just because I felt like I needed to protect whoever I was with.
I see.
Protect myself. And it was, and I would always just, you know, whatever room I was in, it was always shut the door. So then that would give me more time, you know. I think I've been practicing martial arts for the last 10 years, and I think I've been able to breathe a little bit better. It's not because I know self-defense. It's just because, you know, we do a lot of stress situations. So it's been able to desensitize some of that trauma.
And good.
That was to answer that question on the lesson or connecting what happened there.
Gotcha. Thank you for sharing that, for sure. Really appreciate it, Bill. So in your book, man, I mean, there's all sorts of, I hate the term nuggets, but anecdotes, very profound discoveries that you've had in your journey, and things that you are encouraging the reader or encouraging others, you know, to do that's more introspective, like you said, self-love, right? Beyond self-awareness, but self-love. And so, you know, I just want to know, this book can apply to just about anyone from all walks of life. Is that right?
Yeah. I originally thought it was towards, you know, 30 to 60-year-old men.
Yeah.
But then something interesting happened is a lot of the ladies out there were reading the book and they were like, this helped me with my workout. And this helped me here. And now I understand why my husband or my dad or someone acted this way because of what they went through. And,
right.
And so like, there's been a lot of that connection. So it does apply to all walks of life. And I originally just thought I wanted to help some of the dudes out there. And, but it's really connected with the females too, and helping them understand either their themselves, and you know, it's been nice. They're the ladies are a little bit more vulnerable to share their stuff, but when the guys share it, I mean, I know I grew up with some of the toughest dudes, like man's man, like dudes, you know. Like,
oh yeah.
Tough sons of guns, right? And these guys were calling me like Murph, you know. I never knew you had it that bad. I knew your dad was a jerk, but I didn't know you had it that bad. And like, I'm so glad you shared, because something happened here and this happened here. And
so like, yes,
you know, they would be in tears almost as they expressed that. And I never would even imagine some of these guys, you know, crying to me.
Right.
And so like, I actually thought I was going to get punked a little bit from the guy, be like, man, you told it all. That's sacred stuff. Dudes don't talk like that. But I got,
opening up in the book. Yeah.
I got none of that. I'm so thankful that I didn't get any of that, but
it's wonderful
because everybody can connect, and it's just not talked about.
Yes.
Aubrey, here's the scariest thing. Men are four times more likely to commit suicide than women. And why is that?
Wow.
Why is that?
Because repression, women, it sounds like they're repressing.
They're holding it in. They don't talk about it because you're not supposed to talk about it. The stereotype is you don't talk about it. Men don't cry.
Right.
Ladies, you got to go get help. But they do, and they talk about it, and they release, and they have cope. They can cope. Men, hold it in. And then you just hear some of these horrific stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, that's amazing, man. And you know, you and I, we are of the same generation. You know, my father was old school. You know, being African-American, trying to make an honest living to provide for his family. And during a time when, you know, African-Americans made significantly less than, you know, their counterparts, opportunities for good positions and so forth were far more difficult to obtain for an African-American. But, you know, he didn't have to deal with that as much because I'm a military brat. Both my parents served. But but going back to old school, right?
Yeah.
That way of thinking, which is what our fathers put on us, or at least my father put on me, you know, men don't cry. Okay. You don't show that sensitive side. You know, you get hurt, you tough it out, that sort of thing. You know, there is no process your feelings, you know, and that's how it was growing up, you know, and it's to me, it's just a huge release, and it's a huge relief that these men have opened themselves up to you after you initiated it through your book and say, hey, that's happened to me too. I was in your shoes in that same situation you mentioned in chapter two, and down in tears because it's happened to them as well. You know, you give people a sense of hope through your book, Bill, and sharing and being vulnerable and opening up your world and what you've encountered, you know, so they can realize for themselves, hey, I can thrive from this and not let it beat me up through, you know, for the rest of my days. Right. I wanted to ask you, Bill, you have not allowed what happened to you in the past to define who you are. At least that's what I'm picking up from this. What defines you as who you are today, or your future self?
Oh, well, there's been moments when I've misstepped big time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it feels rock bottom. And how am I gonna get out of it? And that's, am I gonna let these circumstances be my identity, or am I gonna get that shovel and dig my way out and keep moving? Again, are the circumstances gonna be my identity? Are they gonna define who I am? And that's what a lot of people do. And that's the convenient excuse to say, I had it so bad. I am who I am because of my parents, because of my grandparents, because of my upbringing, because of the people I hung around. I had it this way, I had it that way. You can help yourself, no matter how bad it was, whatever adversity that you faced. You know, you have a choice to rise up. And so I never took the victim mentality, even though I may have been on the ground a few times wondering what my next step was in life, or even that moment as I lay there, either because I did something wrong or something was done to me. But I knew that I always had to get up and do something about it and take action and not let the adversity define me. And so, you know, the mindsets there are the victim mindsets. When you have these low levels of emotion, which is depression, sadness, anger, hostility, revenge, hopelessness, helplessness, powerlessness, and you let that bring you down, you could survive and just wait for the storm to pass and just say, I'm getting by. Okay, fine. Nothing good or bad may happen in that situation. You're coasting, but then you can go thrive. And that's to take the action, and that's to give, that's to forgive, that's to find love, that's to find peace, that's to find happiness. But you have to do that through a process of being thankful for the things that you do have. And that's your blessings. Yes. If people say, well, I don't have any blessings, that's easy for you. You have money, you have this, you have that. No, you know what? You do have blessings. You have air you're breathing right now. You have a roof over your head. You have food in your belly. You have, you may have great kids. You may have kids that you need to reconnect with. You may have parents that are still around that you can call up. I mean, you have blessings in your life. Find those blessings. That will change your identity. And if you are letting that victim mentality and mindset define you, you can find a thriving mindset with the blessings that you can identify very quickly. And that will change your physiology as well.
I got you. And you talked about mindset, and I appreciate you doing that, because I want to see, and I think you mentioned it somewhere in your book, hardening your mindset. What does that mean, and where does it play in the different mindset patterns that you just mentioned, the victimhood mindset, you know, the transformation mindset? What does it mean to harden your mindset, and is it helpful? Is it harmful? How can the listeners apply that or look out for that, depending on, you know, whether or not it's helpful for them?
Yeah. So I used to think, so when I defined that, I was thinking as, you know, hey, all right, we identified it and it's in the book. I realized I was depressed. And again, old school growing up, if a man was depressed, you would be soft. So I said, I got to harden my mindset here and prove, again, we're proving something, that I can do whatever it takes, still have depression and flourish and thrive by doing great things, whether it's the sports or work or being a good dad or whatever it is. And I'm not going to be soft and let that define me. I'll be hardened. But when you harden things, you're doing things that are, you're building that stress muscle. So you're not coasting anymore. You're doing things that are going to stretch you. You're getting out of your comfort zone, whether it's, if you're in sales and you're prospecting, you say, you know what, I'm going to prospect an hour and you get nothing. And you know what? You get to prospect 2 hours. Well, now this becomes hard. And now this is not fun. And now you have to do the hard things to get to where you want to go. Hey, you're going to go run a marathon. Well, if you only walk up and down your stairs to practice to get to the marathon, you're not going to do that. So you got to get that resilience, that toughness, the awareness built in. So you're building up all these muscles and you're hardening your mind and creating that thriving mindset. But it started with, I won't be soft. I get hardened.
I got you. Kind of like, and it seems like
when you're working out, right? You're building your calluses because you're doing the work.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it sounds, I don't want to say synonymous, but it sounds like there's themes of mental strength and mental toughness that's involved in that hardened mindset. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely.
All right. 100%. Couple more questions here. I really, really appreciate this conversation, Bill. If there is one primary message from this book that you want the readers to get, one significant takeaway from this book, if they don't get anything else from it, what would that takeaway be?
No matter what your past is, your future is spotless. Go get it. Go after it.
Clean canvas. Love it. Love it. Awesome. And Bill, if you could sum this up in one sentence, okay, looking back on your entire journey, the highs, the lows, the ups, the downs, the abuse, the successes, what would you say if you can make one sentence from that entire journey? What is your road to rediscovery?
Make peace with your past. Settle all your unfinished business. Mm-hmm. Don't let adversity define you. Count your blessings towards that thriving mindset.
Love it. Love it, man. Bill, is there any way you can share with the listeners how they can learn more about your journey, pick up a copy of your book and just follow you?
Sure thing. We're on all socials. If you go to thrivinginthestorm.com, we release a weekly newsletter blog on there. A lot of it's getting out of your comfort zone and making peace with your past. We've been covering a lot of biohack stuff that's we've been practicing and working through some things. It's all about the mental health and overall well-being, physical health as well. There's a lot of physical things that we talk about as well as mental exercises. So the book is wherever books are sold, Amazon, and you can also get it on our website and reach out to us.
Awesome. Thrivinginthestorm.com. We will have links to the website, links to your socials, and links to Amazon or wherever else they can purchase the book in the episode show notes so the listeners can click those links, get more information while listening to this wonderful conversation. Bill Murphy, everyone. Bill, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I really, really appreciate you sharing your journey and your insights.
Thank you, Aubrey. You went deep with me, huh?
Well, I appreciate you going deep with me, man. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening. And hey, look, if you have a loved one, a colleague, a coworker, a friend, relative, a neighbor who may not be acting themselves lately. You know, maybe they're going through some dark days of despair, not quite sure where to turn or who to turn to. I humbly ask that you please share this show with them, because on the road to rediscovery, we want our listeners to know two things. Number one, you're not alone. And two, there's always hope. The Road to Rediscovery, it's a movement, a revolution. And guess what? You are now part of it. We're all roadies on this journey of life. And it sure feels good having you on the road with me. Thanks again for listening. We'll chat again soon.
We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Road to Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadtorediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have.